From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. This time last month, we told you the nation's unemployment rate had hit a four-year high. Now, with the August numbers, it has leapt to a five-year high, 6.1%. For the eighth month in a row, businesses cut payrolls. In August, 84,000 jobs were eliminated. Analysts say today's report from the Labor Department suggests more tough times to come for the U.S. economy, as NPR's Frank Langfitt reports.
The American economy is filled with gloomy figures these days. One relatively hopeful sign has been the unemployment rate, until today. In recent months, unemployment has been in the 5% range, but in August, it jumped to 6.1%. Robert Dye is a senior economist with PNC Financial Services in Pittsburgh. He says going over the 6% threshold is worrisome.
It's just another crossing a psychological barrier, because a 5% unemployment rate, we sort of associate that with, you know, near full employment in the U.S.
Dye says over 6% signals a more rapidly deteriorating job market.
And it's going to go up from here. I would not be at all surprised, you know, to see 6.2, 6.3, 6.4%.
The unemployment rate isn't the only bad sign in today's report. Another is the nature of job losses. Not so long ago, layoffs were concentrated in a few weak sectors: manufacturing, construction, and later, mortgage lending.
But what we're seeing in the employment data now is that those job losses are happening in virtually every sector.
That's Nancy Kimmelman. She's an economist and author of Common Sense: How the Economy Really Works. She says the troubles that began with the housing crisis are now spreading across the job market. Take leisure and hospitality. After steady growth, it's lost 20,000 jobs since April. Kimmelman and others blame oil prices and economic anxiety.
Americans aren't going anywhere. This summer was a staycation summer. People stayed close to home. They didn't want to pile up into the car and drive across country because they couldn't afford the gasoline for it.
Kimmelman says economic trouble can spread like a virus, and that's what's happening now.
The construction worker in Indiana coughs, loses his job. Then an individual in Miami Beach or Los Angeles might catch a cold. If that construction worker doesn't take a trip to California, then it causes a retrenchment in the LA economy. Then what seemed like a one-off issue spreads throughout the economy, and the weakness is indeed contagious.
Over the past year, one thing that has helped keep the economy from becoming even worse is exports. A weak dollar has made U.S. products more attractive to other faster-growing countries. Steve Heap works for Vermeer, which makes construction and farm equipment in Pella, Iowa. He says overseas sales have bolstered his company as the U.S. market has slowed. He spoke by cell phone while traveling in Brazil.
In the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen significant growth in Asia, in Eastern Europe, and in the Middle East as well.
And that means exports now support about 700 jobs back home in Iowa. But some companies may have trouble relying on export growth in the future. The U.S. dollar has strengthened recently, and the world economy shows signs of slowing. Nancy Kimmelman expects these trends to continue. As for the U.S. economy, she doesn't think it will rebound until sometime next year. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
High school football season kicks off around the country this week, and this season, small schools have a new way of trying to keep step with larger schools that have linebackers that might make you wonder what they're giving students in their lunchroom. It's called the A-11 offense. It was developed by Coach Kurt Bryan of the Piedmont, California Highlanders. It's an offense that puts 11 possible receivers on the field, makes it easier to trick some of the Goliaths on the other side of the line of scrimmage. Last year was the first season the A-11 hit the field. Piedmont took their new playbook all the way to the playoffs. The A-11 will be tested again Saturday night in the season opener against Sir Francis Drake High School. Piedmont coach Kurt Bryan joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Coach Bryan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott, for having me on today.
Now, is there a quick way of explaining how you put, what is it, 9 potential receivers on the line?
Yeah, sure. If you're a bird looking down at a football field, you can picture 3 receivers split out wide to the left, 3 receivers split out wide to the right, a center and 2 guards or a tight end on either side of the center, and then 2 quarterbacks in the shotgun formation or a quarterback and a running back there. So we spread the field from the numbers to the numbers.
Now, isn't there some regulation? You can only have, what is it, 5 or 6 eligible receivers?
Exactly. What we did is researched the rule book, and we found the key to unlock this new system of football, and it lies in the scrimmage kick formation.
So you line up the same way you would, say, for a kickoff.
Or a PAT or a punt.
A punt, uh-huh. Point after touchdown, yeah, okay.
And as long as you have nobody under center, uh-huh, and at least one potential recipient of the long snap 7 or more yards deep in the backfield, you can then have up to all 11 players wearing an eligible jersey number.
So the defense doesn't know who to block.
Well, yeah, and the defense, more importantly, has to respect the potential threat of anybody who's wearing an eligible number on that particular play.
Does this vastly increase the number of plays you can run?
You know, it's so funny that you asked that. Scientific American just did a study, and it takes your average offensive play from about 35 possible options to over 16,000 just on one formation. It is absolutely wild what it's going to do for the game.
Now, I'm sure all of your football players are young scholars, but isn't that an awful lot of potential plays for them to have to know?
Yeah, it is. And, you got to make sure that you keep it simple. And we had to develop a system that was kind of a cookie cutter, so the coaches and players that were going to learn the A11 offense could see it, they could visualize it, it could be taught and learned at a rapid rate. So that was really critical.
Does it decrease injuries? I'm just guessing, because you have less of the ka-thunk, ka-thunk against each other.
Yeah, it really does decrease injuries. And because the players are so spread out across the field of play, there's a lot less gang tackling, mm-hmm, and a lot less what's called roll-ups. We did not suffer any major injuries last year on the offensive side of the ball due to contact.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But the game is much faster and very exciting for the fans, so everybody wins.
I have to tell you, I logged onto your website to educate myself about the A11, and it's a lot of fun.
One of the benefits that we found is that a lot of different players touch the football, and so it's easier to keep the attention of your players during practice and certainly throughout the game, because they never know where the ball's coming to next play. And, you know, if you take a look at the history of football, it started as a very brutal, compacted game, and it's slowly spread out. And if you take a look down the road at where it's going, the game is only going to become faster and even more spread out. And, you know, I want to see what's going to happen over the next 10 to 20 years as football reveals itself with this new dimension.
What was your record last year, Coach?
We finished 7-3, and then we made the playoffs, and we ended the season 7-4. We lost to a champion, Las Lomas, in the playoff game.
Well, I don't envy Sir Francis Drake.
Well, we got our work cut out for us. It's going to be a tough game. We're looking forward to it.
Kurt Bryan, he's the varsity football coach for the Piedmont Highlanders in Piedmont, California. Coach Bryan, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. This week, the Republican National Convention wrapped up in St. Paul, Minnesota. Huge audiences tuned in to watch and hear Governor Sarah Palin give the biggest speech of her life, and then to hear Senator McCain accept the Republican nomination for president. NPR senior news analyst Dan Schor joins us. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
Firstly, welcome back. And you observed your, may I say, 92nd birthday while you were
observed
gone?
Other people observed it for me, but yes.
All right. Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Now we've got some distance from both conventions. Looking back, what stood out in your mind?
Well, as I look back, one of the things that stands in my mind is that both conventions found unity that has not always happened in either Republican and especially in Democratic history. But Democrats had the great problem of Hillary Clinton and her supporters not being entirely happy. The Republicans had a problem as to who should be the running mate. And in the end, I think that Senator McCain did it sort of toss the ball into the air and choosing Governor Palin. But it all worked. They've all gone home. They're going out to various meetings and rallies and so on. But you have two united parties.
But that does raise the question, if either of those parties is going to win, they have to reach across.
That's correct. It's very interesting that in the history of political conventions, there are always these little buzzwords. One of the big words is change, a little bit about experience. But then you found that it really was that the people wanted something that would take them out of this kind of partisan fight. And in order to do that, you found that your candidates were all busy extending their hands across the invisible barrier.
TV ratings were just almost off the charts, and somewhat unexpectedly. 38 million people tuned in to watch Senator Obama's acceptance speech last week.
Right.
Even more watched John McCain's speech on Thursday.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Governor Palin came close to both with 37 million viewers. Why are so many people paying attention?
I don't know. I think something generational is happening. I think we're beginning to get the effect of what are called the millennials. Sometimes back it was the boomer generation and so on. Now we're having a big realignment, I think, and we're getting younger people coming into the television marketplace and at least looking at what's going on. Also, there was, you have to say, that sometimes a little bit dramatic. I mean, the Mrs. Palin was a genuinely dramatic event, so it does attract attention.
The Republican convention was shortened because of the arrival of Hurricane Gustav, and some people have suggested that this might have been the best thing for the convention formula, that maybe they don't need to be spread over four nights. I wonder what you think.
Well, the fact that it came down to three and nobody seemed to mind that it was only 3 days, Bush delivered his speech to the convention from a remote place called the White House, and it lasted 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to bring that down into 3 days without trying. We'll try three, maybe we'll do two.
Let me share with you some words that Senator McCain uttered in his acceptance speech on Thursday night. He said, quote, we, Republicans, mm-hmm. were elected to change Washington, and we let Washington change us. We lost the trust of the American people when some Republicans gave in to the temptations of corruption. We lost their trust when, rather than reform government, both parties made it bigger.
Interesting.
Well, all right. Now, how does somebody run as the party out of power when they've had the White House for 8 years?
Very delicately.
The way a porcupine makes love.
It's how you do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, Senator McCain is now hung up on the fact that he has supported President Bush and agreed with President Bush and has voted for things that President Bush wants. It is very difficult for him now at this stage to put a lot of distance between him and the previous administration. And so what you read was a very delicate way of saying, listen, some of those people, I'm not going to name them, did some very wrong things and so on. And you're not supposed to know that he really is saying, I'm breaking with Bush.
But Senator McCain does have a record of breaking with Bush. In fact, the two of them tried to break each other 8 years ago.
They have a record of breaking and mending.
How did Governor Palin do, your estimation?
I think she did awfully well. I mean, everybody thinks she did awfully well. This woman known in Alaska, not very well known anywhere else, stood up there, read her speech, whoever wrote it, it was a good speech, and very well delivered. But I must say that for all the main speakers at both conventions, they've all now learned how to speak. Nobody really fell on his face. But I would say that the star was Mrs. Palin.
Something I noticed about these four candidates, the three of them with children above the age of 18,
yes,
their families all have somebody who has either served in or is on their way to serve in Iraq.
Right. And, of course, that was brought forcefully to the attention of the convention and of the world. There's also an enormous emphasis on family. I mean, families have stood up before to watch their nominated spouses, fathers, and so on and so forth. But I thought all through this, with so many of them having family and so on, that they really find that presenting family to the public helps, and it does.
Thanks very much, Dan Shore.
Sure.
Not sure of the vintage of that dusty old bottle of Saint-Emilion sitting in the basement next to your collection of old running shoes? Well, the Antique Wine Company of London may be able to help. They've collaborated with French scientists to use ions generated by a particle accelerator to read the age of the wine bottle without damaging what's inside. Joining us now from Moscow is Stephen Williams, who's managing director of the Antique Wine Company. Thanks very much for being with us.
That's a pleasure, Scott.
So how can it read the age of the stuff inside without opening the bottle?
Basically, we fire out of a particle accelerator a very weak but high voltage beam at the glass of the bottle, and this then emits x-ray, and these x-rays are analyzed so that we can actually see what the process of manufacture was used when the bottle was made, and that gives us a very strong indication of the type of furnace that was used and the age of the actual glass itself. What we're doing at present is we're building up a database of absolutely authentic references that are being provided to us by the various chateaus. We're analyzing wines that have never moved in their history so that we know that our benchmark data is absolutely robust and reliable, against which in the future other bottles will be compared.
Now, I must ask, is that because there's a lot of fraud going on in vintage wine?
Well, the same as all collectibles, art and wine is not any different to that. There has probably been foul play. We don't think that counterfeit wines are prolific in the market, but they probably do exist.
May I ask, Mr. Williams, does anybody really open up a 100-year-old bottle of wine and drink it?
Yes, I think most wine collectors actually enjoy drinking wine as well as just looking at it. So this happens quite often. And in these days, you know, these collectors are people all over the world. And in these emerging economies, wine is often used as an element of sophistication, to provide an element of sophistication, a Western lifestyle. And often people just want to drink the very best. These are sometimes very valuable and old wines.
Is there a bottle of wine you'd, well, just personally, you'd love to get your hands on, love to taste?
One of my favorites is the Chateau Margaux 1900 vintage. And the last time I tasted that wine actually was about 10 years ago, and it was still drinking absolutely delicious.
How much might they run, in theory?
Probably around $20,000 a bottle.
So you just don't eat that with peanuts, do you?
No, that would be a great shame, wouldn't it, really?
Stephen Williams of the Antique Wine Company, speaking with us from Moscow. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Scott.
This is NPR News.
This week at the Republican convention, one recurring theme was this: America is at war, and it needs a qualified commander-in-chief. Commentator Ken Harbaugh is a former Navy pilot, and he wants voters to understand the unique power a president can exercise as commander of America's military.
Last night, Senator John McCain delivered an acceptance speech in which he reiterated his qualifications to be commander-in-chief. Senator Barack Obama's speech last week was equally emphatic about his ability to lead our armed forces. Should we, as a nation, focus so much energy on just one part of what it means to be president? Yes. Being commander-in-chief is the most important job a president has. I know that might sound like one voter's vanity. I grew up in a military family. I joined the Navy after college. I am what you might call a military voter. Why should my issue matter most? The truth is that I and my military buddies do care about a variety of issues. But on everything else, schools, jobs, healthcare, executive power is balanced by the other branches. Even foreign policy and defense spending are worked out with Congress. When the commander-in-chief orders Americans to die for their country, there is no real check and balance. That authority is constitutionally protected. When we choose a president, we give one person almost unbridled military power. Short of impeachment, there's not a lot we can do to take it back. That's why, even in hugely unpopular wars, presidents are able to exercise powers unimaginable elsewhere in government. As a military voter, I know I'm outnumbered. Most of my fellow citizens have never served in uniform. I believe, however, that this is one of America's greatest strengths. Think about it. The world's most powerful military commander is a civilian, chosen almost entirely by other civilians. What then makes a good commander-in-chief? It's not always prior military service. Some of our best wartime leaders never wore a uniform. Judgment matters at least as much as experience, as does integrity and temperament. I suppose this is where I identify the best candidate. I'm not going to do that. Our system depends on each voter exercising their own judgment. That's collective wisdom, and it is what makes democracy work. It's not enough, however, to know the candidates, their strengths and their weaknesses. Voters must also understand the powers of the office, and none is greater nor more unrestrained than those of commander-in-chief. That's not just one voter's vanity. That's the Constitution. Come November, when you enter that voting booth, remember that the lives of our men and women in uniform depend on who sits in the Oval Office. It falls to us to choose a leader worthy of commanding them. In the end, we are all military voters.
Ken Harbaugh is executive director of the Center for Citizen Leadership. That's a nonprofit that helps wounded veterans work as community volunteers.